Here on FM, our new book of the week. Philip Larkin was a controversial character, often portrayed as a racist and misogynist. But those close to him describe him as witty, entertaining, considerate and kind. Now, James Booth, an ex-colleague and literary advisor to the Larkin Society, takes a fresh look at the poet's reputation in a new biography, Philip Larkin, Life, Art and Love. The reader is Michael Pennington.
In 1953, on holiday in Weymouth, Philip Larkin was moved to hear his widowed mother, Eva, quoting snatches of poems by Thomas Hardy, which he had learnt by heart, simply to please my father. He was prompted to reflect on his parents' first meeting, half a century earlier in 1906. Oh, frigid, inarticulate man. He met my mother on the beach at Rhyl. Before leaving, he had a picture of them taken together and exchanged addresses. And despite a separation of several years, his intentions didn't alter. I find all that very strange and romantic, partly because unlike the father I knew. He must have been as intensely idealistic as a young man as he was nihilistically disillusioned in middle age. After his father, Sidney, died, Larkin analysed the marriage with brutal objectivity. His personality had imposed this taut, ungenerous, defeated pattern of life on the family, and it was only to be expected that it would make them miserable. It was his parents' example that taught him his passionate antipathy to marriage. The monotonous, whining monologues that his mother inflicted on the family, resentful, self-pitying, full of funk and suspicion, remained in his mind as something I mustn't, under any circumstances, risk encountering again. The marriage left me with two convictions, that human beings should not live together, and that children should be taken from their parents at an early age. On the other hand, in his interview with The Observer in 1979, he expressed relief that his line, "They f*** you up, your mum and dad," had not been included in the current Oxford Dictionary of Quotations. I wouldn't want it thought that I didn't like my parents, but they were rather awkward people and not very good at being happy. Larkin claimed that when he later tried to tune into his childhood in Coventry with his older sister, Kitty, the emotions he picked up were overwhelmingly fear and boredom. It was all very normal. I had friends whom I played football and cricket with and Hornby trains and so forth. A school friend later recalled the intimidating tidiness of his house, its highly waxed furniture and the practice of hushed conversation, though Mrs. Larkin always welcomed him with unfailing graciousness. Philip Larkin's warmest recollections were of jazz. I became a jazz addict at the age of 12 or 13, listened avidly to all the dance bands of the day, and tried to learn to play the drums. On Saturday afternoons, we sat frowning intently in the glass cubicles at Hanson's, trying to decide whether both sides of the latest Parlophone Rhythm Style series or Vocalion Swing series were sufficiently good to justify expenditure of the record's stiffish price of 3 shillings. Sidney Larkin's influence on his son was intense and lasting. Sidney's political instincts were coarse, and he shared the anti-Semitism of many of his class and generation. As city treasurer of Coventry, he attended international conferences in Berlin, and during the 30s he brightened up his office in Coventry with Nazi paraphernalia brought back from Nuremberg rallies. There are virtually no expressions of political belief in Philip Larkin's letters of the later 1940s and 1950s, and those which are detectable show him leaning towards the left. He remained in crucial respects, however, his father's son. Sidney told him never to believe in God, and also imparted to his son his own adventurous appetite for literature. Larkin later recalled with gratitude that his father had filled the house with works by Hardy, Shaw, Wilde, D.H. Lawrence, and Catherine Mansfield. From an early age, Philip made full use of the local lending library. I suppose I must have read a book a day. He also took early to writing, pouring out prose and verse in abundance. Like his father, he used for preference a 2B Royal Sovereign pencil, and his handwriting, fluent and regular, is uncannily similar to his father's. Before going up to Oxford to read English at St. John's College, the 17-year-old Larkin reviewed his writings up to that point, burning much and preserving an anthology of the best, fragments of novels, poems, satirical playlets and essays. He had ambitions to be a novelist, but it was in poetry that he made his first real start. In the autumn of 1940, he sent 5 poems to the Listener, one of which, Ultimatum, was accepted for publication. As an undergraduate, Larkin wrote a steady stream of informative and entertaining letters and cards to his parents, Pop and Mop, or Dear Family, sometimes separately, sometimes jointly. On Monday, I attended my first lecture, Edmund Blunden talking about biography. Very strange. The description of the matriculation ceremony is clearly intended for his proud mother's eyes. This entailed dressing up in all the full apparel. I didn't look half bad at all. Being blessed in Latin by the vice-chancellor. This was conducted to the accompaniment of bombers overhead. God, there are hundreds. My Latin name, by the way, is Philippus Arturus Larkin. In wartime, Oxford was underpopulated and the atmosphere muted. The age and specifications for call-up into the army were constantly being revised, and undergraduates knew that their studies might be interrupted at any time. On the 14th of November 1940, only weeks after he had left Coventry, the first major blitz of the war was visited on his home city, killing 554 people and injuring 1,000. Larkin hitchhiked home at once in desperate anxiety to find his family unharmed.
Dig, man, there goes Mac the Knife.
On the 5th of May 1941, Larkin met Kingsley Amis in the quadrangle of St. John's College, and they at once developed an intimate masculine bond. Amis demanded that his friend be an exact replica of himself. I enjoy talking to you more than to anybody else, because you are savagely uninterested in all the things I am uninterested in. Larkin obliged by adopting Amos's tone of beer-drinking, jazz-loving ribaldry. He soon introduced his new friend to his record collection. Kingsley's enthusiasm flared up immediately. I suppose we devoted to some 100 records that early anatomizing passion normally reserved for the more established arts. Amis was also an ally in Larkin's quest for poetic recognition. As editor of the Labour Club Bulletin, Amis published Larkin's poems Observation and Disintegration. His determination to be in the literary swim was intense. He became treasurer of the University English Club, and over the next 2 years was involved in entertaining a wide variety of speakers, including Stephen Spender, George Orwell, and Dylan Thomas. On the 16th of November, Larkin wrote to his friend Jim Sutton, "MacReady and I shagged up to London to attend a jam session at HMV Studios in St. John's Wood." He was filled with excitement at being present at an historic occasion, the first jam session indeed to be recorded in England. The young poet was enjoying his new experiences. He was popular and happy. He wrote to Sutton, who had been called up, with shocking candour, "Perhaps you think I'm being a bit selfish, but I just don't want to go into the army. I want to pretend it isn't there, that there's no war on." At his army medical, Larkin was told that if his eyesight was graded 4 or below, he would be exempt. "On New Year's Day, I received my hideous letter marked OHMS in bed. It informed me that my medical category was 4. Never have I, except at the news of the Munich Agreement, felt so relieved." When 3 poems appeared in Oxford Poetry in 1942-43, Larkin could feel that he was beginning to make some progress as a poet. After his final examinations, he glumly prepared his parents for that hallmark of imbecility, a third-class degree. But he was more successful than he expected, underlining first 13 times in a letter to Jim Sutton. The charmed world he had inhabited over the last few months was fading about him. On his birthday, the 9th of August, Larkin had submitted himself miserably to be interviewed for a job in the civil service. His application was rejected. In September, he was considered for a Foreign Office post doing secret work at Bletchley Park and was again rejected. Ashamed of his failure, he fumed to Amos, "I detest being inspected and weighed up and classed as unfit for this imbecile job or fit for that imbecile job or suitable for such and such lunatic task. I boil and spit with fury." Finally, early in November, his future was decided. "I was sitting at home quietly writing when the Ministry of Labour wrote to me, asking very courteously what I was doing exactly. This scared me, and I picked up the Birmingham Post and saw that an urban district council in Shropshire wanted a librarian, so I applied and got it." Wellington was, on the face of it, an unpromising place for a young man of 21 to start a literary career. But Philip Larkin set about modernising the library's antiquated systems and procedures. When he arrived, the library's stock consisted of only 4,000 books, and his purchases of works by Lawrence, Forster, Joyce and Isherwood gained him a reputation for filling the library with dirty books. His life settled into a bachelor pattern. He played snooker at the local YMCA, he visited cafes and the town's three cinemas with local girls, and wrote in his spare time. In a letter to Jim Sutton, Larkin expressed a somewhat baffled respect for the quiet men in cloth caps who take out books of a rather serious kind with a serious expression on their faces, as if they are seriously trying to get a grip on things. The reading choices of the female library users disappointed him. "I hate women when it comes to choosing books." But he involved himself in the needs and ambitions of the local library users. To older readers, he was unfailingly courteous, and his diffidence and nervous stammer, together with his patient willingness to find them books they would enjoy, won them over completely. One library user on whom he made a particularly deep impression was Ruth Bowman, a 16-year-old schoolgirl. Here was someone glamorized by an Oxford degree, mature, learned, and successful. I was dazzled. By early 1944, there was amused gossip in the town about the awkward couple they made. An acquaintance often saw them together reciting poetry to each other. She looked at him with such adoring eyes. The following year, Ruth, aged 18, was accepted to read English at King's College London, and her imminent departure prompted their first sexual encounter. Shortly afterwards, she wrote humbly from London, "The fact that you have made love to me is the greatest source of pride and happiness in my life." There is something ominous in her past tense, as though she was steeling herself for the end of the relationship. But Larkin was loyal, and the relationship struggled on until he met Monica Jones, the witty, beautiful, if also difficult and vulnerable woman, to whom he was to become attached for the rest of his life.
Michael Pennington was reading from Philip Larkin, Life, Art and Love by James Booth. It was abridged by Libby Spurrier, produced by Joanna Green, and is a peer production for BBC Radio 4. Can men and women ever be just friends? Well, Jane Garvey and Tim Samuels are giving it a try once again as they bring together Radio 4's Woman's Hour and Radio 5 Live's Men's Hour for what's becoming a bit of a regular date, a joint bank holiday special after the news. But first, I'll look ahead to Wednesday morning.
In the age of the soundbite, we rarely hear politicians reflect in depth on the experiences and ideas that shaped them, or on the people who inspired or irritated them. Join me, Peter Hennessy, for Reflections, in which I ask seasoned politicians to look back on their life and times. My guest in the next programme is David Steele, Lord Steele of Akewood, the former Liberal Party leader who's been a presence in our national conversation since he first became an MP in 1965, aged just 26. That's Reflections with me, Peter Hennessy, this Wednesday morning at 9 on BBC Radio 4.